This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The International Criminal Court has found the former Congolese rebel, Bosco Ntaganda, guilty Monday of all 18 counts of war crimes against humanity. The rebel leader had denied being a killer and war criminal when he spoke at his trial Thursday. ICC prosecutors say he commanded a rebel group that killed, raped, and exploited people in Congo's eastern Ituri province in 2002 and 2003. Prosecutors called dozens of witnesses to testify against him. The United Nations Atomic Energy Agency confirmed Monday that Iran has surpassed the limit on how much uranium it is allowed to enrich under the 2015 International Nuclear Deal. Iran announced earlier in the day that it had surpassed the limit in breach of the agreement aimed at restraining Tehran's nuclear weapons development. Iran said it passed 4.5% enrichment. John Gambrel has more.
That may not sound like a big number, but the reason why the authorities had sought the 3.67% is because it's a low enough number that it can power nuclear power plants and be used for other peaceful purposes, but it doesn't start to edge up towards weapons-grade levels of 90%.
Iran said it could consider enriching uranium to 20% as it abandons its commitments under the nuclear deal, unless it keeps and gets help from the accord's other signatories to overcome the crippling effect of U.S. economic sanctions. U.S. President Donald Trump said Monday he would no longer deal with Britain's ambassador to Washington, Kim Derrick, after the key envoy disparaged him as inept, insecure, and incompetent, and his administration as uniquely dysfunctional. British authorities are investigating who might be responsible for Monday's leak of diplomatic cables. This is VOA News. Jeffrey Epstein, a U.S. hedge fund billionaire with links to top politicians and celebrities, pled not guilty Monday to charges that he ran a sex trafficking ring that allegedly exploited dozens of underage girls.
U.S. Attorney Jeff Berman of Southern New York accuses billionaire financier Jeffrey Epstein of sexually abusing dozens of young girls, some as young as 14, at his homes in New York and Florida.
First, conspiracy to commit sex trafficking, and second, the substantive crime of sex trafficking of underage girls.
Epstein is accused of paying underage girls hundreds of dollars in cash for massages and then molesting them from 2002 through 2005. He's also accused of getting some of the teenagers to recruit others for him. Prosecutors oppose his release on bail. His bail hearing is next Monday. I'm Tim McGuire.
Afghan authorities say they have arrested four Islamic State operatives, including a university teacher, during a counterterrorism raid in Kabul. The arrests come amid recent reports the Middle Eastern terrorist group has grown into a major security challenge for U.S.-backed Afghan forces struggling to contain the Taliban insurgency. While announcing the arrest, Afghanistan's spy agency said the suspects were involved in recruiting fighters for IS and organizing terrorist attacks in and around the capital city. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet said Monday that she is appalled by the conditions in migrant detention centers in the United States. We get more from Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA from Geneva.
UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet calls conditions in these detention camps appalling for both adult and child refugees and migrants, but especially so for the children. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA the High Commissioner feels personally stricken by the plight of the children.
She's deeply shocked from all these perspectives at the way that children are being forced to sleep on the floor in overcrowded facilities without access to adequate health care or food. And these are conditions that have been documented by the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General itself.
Kevin McAleenan, the acting secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, maintained on Sunday that reports of unsanitary conditions and inadequate food and water are unsubstantiated. He said steps are being taken to improve the detention centers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Money Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today's Tuesday, July 9th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. An agreement to create a joint military-civilian council is expected to be signed today in Sudan's capital, Khartoum.
This is not a comprehensive agreement, and we have reservation about any bilateral because we are in a transitional period which is supposed to be not dominated by one faction or two factions.
Bashar Adam Rahman is the Deputy General Secretary of the Popular Congress Party of Sudan. South Sudan celebrates its independence anniversary today, but there will be no public ceremonies due to economic hardship. The African Union launches a continent-wide free trade area, and a Human Rights Watch official welcomes the conviction of Congolese warlord Bosco Ntaganda.
This verdict is highly significant for the thousands of people across eastern Congo who have suffered, witnessed, or documented serious abuses committed by him and his troops.
Maria Elena Vignoli is an International Justice Counsel at Human Rights Watch. Kenyan women enter the fight against terrorism, and a Senegalese conservative group is targeting the country's LGBTQ community. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's Military Transitional Council and an opposition coalition are expected to sign an agreement today to create a joint military-civilian council that will run the affairs of the country for 3 years before elections. The deal, brokered by the African Union and Ethiopia, also seeks to ease political tension in the country. The agreement followed nationwide protests, which led to the overthrow of former President Omar al-Bashir. But Sudanese opposition Popular Congress Party says it has reservations about the agreement. Dr. Bashar Adam Rahman is the Deputy General Secretary of the Popular Congress Party.
In our view, this is not a comprehensive agreement. It's a bilateral agreement, and we have reservation about any bilateral because we are in a transitional period which is supposed to be not dominated by one faction or two factions, but all the political parties and the rebels in the Sudan should share in that. And we don't know how they are going to settle their differences in the future.
So what other reservations does your party have concerning this agreement?
There is a point which I want to be clear about it. We don't want to share in the institutions of the transitional period. We are not going to share in the ministerial council, not in the sovereignty council. But we will not be left out from parliament of the transitional period, if any. They are going to make a parliament because this parliament will pave the way for the coming elections.
Sudan's top general says that the ruling military council will be dissolved after the formation of a new power-sharing body that will rule the country. What is your party's stance on that?
That's good. We appreciate that. And now what we are saying for the FFC is better for us as political parties, civilians, that we come together and negotiate a plan for the transitional period regardless of the TMC. And then if we agree on something, we go to the TMC and say, okay, this is our plan for the transitional period. And if they are going to dissolve, that's the military council, that is good, and this will pave the way for a civilian rule.
Wouldn't your party risk being sidelined following the overwhelming welcome by the Sudanese population and those protesters who pressured for President Bashir to be kicked out? If you are not in agreement with this measure that is coming up, wouldn't you be sidelined?
No, not at all. We will not be sidelined. Now we are a very prominent coalition. As I told you, we have the national political forces, which is now a collision between our party, the other political parties like the Unionist Party, and the rebels of Darfur and the marginalized areas. This is the majority. So now the marginalized areas are not happy with what they have reached. But there is a good point. if they are going to have a non-aligned people to the political parties to rule the transitional period, that is our idea. We don't want someone who is affiliated to any political party to assume, for instance, a ministerial job, sovereignty council.
Dr. Bashir Adam Orahaman is the Deputy General Secretary of the Opposition Popular Congress Party of Sudan. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotte from the capital, Khartoum. South Sudan is today commemorating the 8th anniversary of its independence, but the government says there will be no public ceremonies due to economic hardship. The hope and jubilation that many South Sudanese felt during independence in 2011 were dashed in December 2013 when President Salva Kiir accused his former deputy Riek Machar and others of attempting to overthrow him. Machar denied the accusation and fled the country. A peace deal was reached in 2018, but its implementation has been elusive. Today, South Sudan is mired in acute hunger. Tens of thousands of its citizens are displaced, and the country faces non-payment of civil service salaries. Information Minister Michael McQuay says there will be no public ceremonies. Instead, he said the money that would have been used will go towards the payment of salaries.
On the occasion of the 8th anniversary of the Republic of South Sudan, His Excellency the President has directed that we should not celebrate that high profile so that we can use the resources available for the payment of salaries and for meeting any other government obligations, including the implementation of the agreement. So His Excellency the President will make a nation address whereby he will be talking to the people of the South Sudan and the diaspora and the international community on the occasion. As for the people of South Sudan, they will have to celebrate their usual way. In addition to that, the theme for this celebration is peace, forgiveness, and unity.
Mr. Minister, people say that the reason that the government cannot pay salaries is because of the delay in the implementation of the peace process. What's the progress in the peace process?
Well, of course, the delay in the salaries, this is the main reason why the government is not celebrating the Independence Day at that level, so that we can pay the salaries, render any other services, including implementation of the agreement. So tomorrow, which is by now morning with us, His Excellency the President will address the nation under the theme peace, forgiveness, and unity.
When the President talked about peace, unity, and forgiveness, do you think the people of South Sudan should believe him? Because since 2013, the government and the rebels in Riek Machar, you have been talking about peace, and nothing has happened.
Well, I don't know what is your yardstick for measuring peace and unity among the people of South Sudan. But so far, the President, in his address to the nation, will address these issues, because without peace there cannot be forgiveness, and without peace there cannot be unity.
Would President Salva Kiir be willing to forgive all the other people who he accused of trying to overthrow him?
Well, for the non-signatories, he will ultimately appeal to them to join him in our quest for peace, because peace cannot come unless all the parties who are not signatory to the agreement sign the agreement and they commit themselves to the peace process.
I know the President is going to be speaking Tuesday on the Independence Day, but give the people of South Sudan that will be listening to us this morning a hopeful sign that peace will come eventually.
Well, of course, for President Salva, he's committed to peace and he's working hard to ensure that peace prevails in South Sudan. Not him alone, but all the parties who are signatories to the agreement are doing the same, and he will work hard to ensure that all those who have not signed the agreement join President Salva Kiir Mayardit in his efforts and his endeavor to ensure that peace comes to South Sudan.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 9th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The African Continental Free Trade Area was launched in Niger's capital, Niamey, on Sunday at the opening of the African Union Summit. The agreement, signed by 54 of the 55 African nations, will form the largest free trade area in the world. While there is much hope that pan-African trade will grow, structural weaknesses are expected to make it a slow process. Moki Edwin Kinzeka narrates this report by Anne Nzuoku in Niamey, Niger.
At the African Union Summit in Niger, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari launched the African Continental Free Trade Area by signing the continent's largest economy onto the deal. After months of reluctance over competition concerns, Nigeria's support gives weight to forming the world's largest free trade zone, a 55-nation bloc worth $3.4 trillion. Pat Utomi is a member of the Nigerian negotiating team.
So Nigeria stands to profit. Other African countries stand to profit also from Nigeria being engaged. It will not only lead to Nigeria's economy becoming bigger, but lead to those other African economies becoming stronger and much bigger. So together, the mutual benefits of trade will lead to elevating the Nigerian's African status away from the poverty of today.
Intra-African trade makes up only 17% of exports, which are hampered by poor infrastructure, taxes, bureaucracy, and corruption. The trade pact aims to boost cross-border trade by reducing or eliminating duties and red tape. To help lower costs, the AU launched a pan-African payment system at the summit in Niger's capital. Oke Orama, the president of the African Export-Import Bank, explains the aim of that pan-African system.
African trade today is conducted on U.S. dollars, euro, and increasingly renminbi. What this is doing is to reduce the use of third currencies in the bilateral trade settlement in Africa, because we estimate that that costs Africa between $5 to $7 billion. And beyond that, it also reduces the trade, because Africa has scarcity of foreign exchange.
African exporters want the free trade area to quickly enter into force to eliminate barriers and create free movement between states. Adama Haruna, the coordinator of Niamey Onion Exporters, wants customs barriers to be broken.
Nous sommes dans une communauté qui est la CEDEAO. La CEDEAO, c'est
Haruna says he does not understand why, for example, a person from Niger who goes with his goods to Burkina still finds constraints there. He adds it is a problem between states. He wants states to review this situation. Despite the African Free Trade Area's launch, much work remains before the agreement becomes effective. While all of the African Union's 55 members, except Eritrea, have signed on to the free trade area, only half have ratified the deal. And even after costs are reduced, Africa's exporters will still have to contend with non-tariff barriers that will take much longer to fix, such as corruption and poor transport links between nations. For Anne Zwanke in Niamey, Niger, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
A Human Rights Watch official says the guilty verdict of Congolese warlord Bosco Ntaganda should serve as a warning to other war crimes perpetrators. A panel of three judges Monday found Ntaganda guilty of 13 counts of war crimes and 5 counts of crimes against humanity committed in Ituri, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, in 2002 and 2003. The charges included murder, rape, and sexual slavery. Maria Elena Vignoli, International Justice Council at Human Rights Watch, says the International Criminal Court and the new Congolese government should work together to bring to trial many more of those responsible for crimes against humanity.
This verdict is highly significant for the thousands of people across eastern Congo who have suffered, witnessed, or documented serious abuses committed by him and his troops. So seeing Taganov on the dock and judged by the ICC is also a powerful reminder to other leaders of abusive armed groups that they too could face prosecution one day.
Could you describe just briefly for our listeners the type of crimes for which Ntaganda was found guilty?
Taganda was found guilty of 18 counts in total, 13 counts of war crimes and 5 counts of crimes against humanity committed in the context of the armed conflict in Ituri, eastern Congo, in 2002-2003, a conflict between the Hema and the Lendu ethnic groups. And these crimes included murder and attempted murder, rape, sexual slavery, attacking civilians, pillaging, displacement of civilians, attacking protected objects, and recruiting and using child soldiers under the age of 15. And what's particularly relevant for this case is that if upheld on appeal, this could become the first final conviction at the ICC for crimes of sexual violence. And this is the first time that the ICC has convicted a commander for sexual violence offenses committed by his troops against other members of the same force.
Other than his conviction, what happens now to his alleged victims? I mean, is there any reparation or reward for them?
So the reparation proceedings will start now that he's been convicted, and the judges can start with preliminary proceedings. They can get up until basically issuing an order for reparation, but the order cannot be implemented until the conviction is final, meaning until the appeal phase is concluded. But the conviction can start the preparation phase for the reparation proceedings.
There is a new government in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and there are still other Congolese warlords in that country. What would you like for the new government, President Félix Tshisekedi, to do now?
We are calling the new government to really commit to strengthen its efforts to investigate and prosecute grave crimes domestically, because, as you said, there are still thousands of victims of other atrocity crimes in Congo who are awaiting justice. And even just recently, we saw a resurgence of violence in eastern Congo in Ituri, which really has highlighted the need to address the pervasive impunity. On the other hand, we also would like to see the ICC prosecutor formulating a clear strategy to address outstanding accountability needs in Congo. And this should include, of course, supporting Congolese authorities.
Thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
Of course. Thank you. Have a good day.
Maria Elena Vignoli is International Justice Counsel at Human Rights Watch. She is speaking with me from New York. Kenyan women have joined the fight against terrorism in their country. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
The organization Sisters Without Borders was formed in 2014. One of its missions is to bridge the mistrust between Kenyan security agencies and families of terrorism suspects. The organization includes at least 20 women groups from Nairobi, Mombasa and Garissa, all of which have seen deadly terrorist attacks by Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. Soraya Hirsi, a member of the Sisters group from Mombasa, attended the conference in Nairobi. She says it is time for women to take an active role in the fight against terrorism. The reason I joined this sisters group, it is because I have been affected. She says, I have family members, people whom I know youths who have been recruited, and this is happening because as a community, we don't speak up about these issues. As a woman who is lucky and also educated, I've decided to be on the front line to help my community so that we can speak about these issues that affect our community, Hirsi says. Nicoleta Barbera is a program officer at the U.S. Institute of Peace. She says women can play a key role in preventing young people from going down the terrorist path.
The women that we work with in Sisters Without Borders are integral in the communities in which they live, work, and serve. So they are very aware of the threats that are in their homes, in their markets, in their communities, and we enable them to identify those potential individuals who are prone to engaging with violent extremism and give them the skills to try and mitigate them at the very beginning when they see those initial signs of radicalization.
Kenya National Counterterrorism Center Director Martin Kimani says that kind of ground-level activism is exactly what the country needs.
We in the security services are hunting and looking for recruiters to put them behind bars where they belong. But radicalization continues to be a problem, and this problem is going to need for these county-level actions.
Kenya has been prime recruiting territory for Al-Shabaab since 2011, when the government sent troops into Somalia to fight militants. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
The Senegalese conservative group Jamra has targeted the country's LGBT community over what they say is an unfair firing by Oxfam Senegal of one of its staff members. The staff member said he was fired because he refused to support their agenda to improve LGBT rights. Other sources said he was fired for political comments he made that had nothing to do with LGBT rights. Francois Patouel, a West Africa researcher with Amnesty International, says the LGBTQ community in Senegal continues to face widespread and dangerous discrimination.
Jamra has made a statement about a disciplinary process happening in an international NGO against a member of staff of that international NGO. And I think that the fact that Jamra has come out really shows the hostility that there is in Senegal for LGBTI rights and how difficult of an environment it is for LGBTI people.
What kind of human rights issues are the LGBT community faced with on a daily basis? Jamra is extremely loud and vocal, but is it not just Jamra? Is it also, you know, daily obstacles that the LGBT community faces?
Yes. I mean, under Senegalese law, unnatural acts, which is consensual same-sex relations, are criminalized. So you can face jail if you are having sex with someone, with an individual of the same sex. So the fact that this is criminalized means that you can face prison, but it's also a barrier to you accessing justice, because let's say you face homophobic violence, for instance, it's very difficult for you to go to police station and explain that, you know, you were a victim of a homophobic crime, because again, you might be the one that end up in jail for being gay or lesbian. It's also a barrier to you of accessing health services, because you're less likely to go to your doctor and say, well, you know, here is my situation, and I'm an LGBTI person. You know, what kind of medical attention may I need? You're less likely to be open and transparent.
I think one of the things that speaks to it in the ongoing struggle, especially long term, for the LGBTQ community in Senegal is that groups like Jamra can latch on to this "it's the Western invention" narrative when, in fact, that's obviously not true. How dangerous is that to progressing, to changing Senegal's laws to make it easier for LGBT community to live?
So the first thing is to highlight that this is wrong. You know, LGBTI rights is not being imported by the West. It's that you also have African human rights instruments that have adopted the resolutions on LGBTI rights. The African Commission on Human and People's Rights, for instance, has adopted a resolution in 2014 calling on African states to end violence against LGBTI groups.
Francois Patouel is a West Africa researcher with Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Senegal's capital, Dakar. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Sudan's military transitional council and an opposition coalition are expected to sign an agreement today to create a joint military-civilian council that will run the affairs of the country for 3 years before elections. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a good day, Africa.
This just in. All of July, Border Crossings is having a very special CD giveaway. If you're looking to listen to the top songs of the summer, we've got the CD for you. Every weekday, we'll be giving away Now That's What I Call Hits and Remixes 2019. Hooray! The CD presents an 18-track lineup of this year's top singles and remixes to date. You'll have access to the hottest artists of the summer, including Taylor Swift.
Are you ready for it?
Marshmello and Selena Gomez.
I've been running through the jungle, I've been running with the wolves to get to you.
Shawn Mendes,
There's Nothing Holding Me Back,
Maroon 5,
Can You Turn Around, Can You Turn Around, Just Where,
and so many more. Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time all of July to be able to listen to the top hits all summer long.